Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, listeners. Tim Sylvie here. We're back for another episode, and I need to head across the airwaves to bring in my co-host, motorsport content king, YouTube extraordinaire, man of the people, Tom McCluskey. How are you, my friend?
Hey, I love that, man of the people. I'm happy to adopt that title, even though not all the people agree with me. But you know what?
Man of some
That's people. Fine. That's life, Tim. Yeah. You know?
This is life. And you were at the F1 arcade gig the other week, weren't you? How was it? Is it any good?
It was very, very fun. The bar was very, very free, which was great. Excellent. And I had a good time. I actually briefly bumped into one of our guests today. I hope I didn't embarrass myself too much, but we'll talk about that anyway.
You probably did with a free bar. The other great free bar is the race awards. Are you going to go to that one? Were you there last time?
Well, not yet, but I'm going to have to knock on some doors and potentially. I'd love to.
That was a very free bar. I remember nearly none of it, but it's coming up, I think, early next year, so I expect I'll be there again, capitalising on free stuff. Should we bring in today's guests?
Let's do it.
So today we are joined by the motorsport power couple. Chris Medland studied sports journalism before jumping into the world of Formula One. He joined ESPN in 2011, then becoming Racer Magazine's F1 correspondent. He's appeared on TV shows and radio and amassed a social following that could fill Wembley Stadium several times over. He's alongside Jess McFadden, no, not Jessica McFadden, the popular New Zealand cricketer who's wicketkeeper for the Wellington Blaze, but the trailblazing motorsport Jess McFadden, currently the director of digital strategy at the Motorsport Network and formerly head of WTF1. She's an inspiration to women around the world. It's a pleasure to have both her and Chris here to chat about their lives, career, thoughts and opinions. Jess, Chris, a very warm welcome to the Motormouth podcast. How are we doing? Before we get into it, a really quick message. This show has grown into something far bigger than we ever imagined. It's been a huge honour to chat with F1 world champions like Nico Rosberg, legends like Mario Andretti, Jody Scheckter and Gerhard Berger. People right at the top of the sport like the brilliant Günther Steiner and current stars like Alex Albon, Lucas Degrassi and Tatiana Calderon. It really is a privilege. But without you, we wouldn't be able to continue. And without sponsors, we couldn't bring you the stories from the inner workings of the sport we all love. With that in mind, I'm over the moon to have F1 Experiences back with us to support the show for season 13. It's really important to us that we align with brands that are relevant and can add value to you. F1 Experiences is the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One, and it's the closest thing you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. You can book with them today. With F1 Experiences' official ticket packages coming direct from Formula One, you can get unique access that simply isn't available anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 Experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 Experience package by using the code MMPODCAST when checking out online. Good things come to those who listen to the Motormouth podcast. Don't say we don't treat you well. So, what are you waiting for? The 2023 F1 season will be here before you know it, so go get booking your F1 Experience today with f1experiences.com.
Very well, aren't we?
Yeah, we're doing good.
We're not too bad. Are you going to correct on your surname?
No, do you know what?
Go on.
I mean, this is part of the reason why we're getting married next year, so I can do away with the with my surname. But it's genuinely, it's a bit of a mouthful. It's McFadden.
No way.
Like, say it. Yeah, you say it how you say it how you see it.
You say it how you see it.
McFadden. It's got a Y in there. The Y is, you know, there's nothing wrong with a Y.
No, that's
so,
that's a good point.
Yeah, I tend not to correct people because I pretty much answer to anything. So there we go.
Brilliant. I love it. And also, your background settings for today, Jess, I know you're covering that lovely hat collection as well.
Lovely hat collection.
We saw at the start. What's going on there? So where are you? Where is this location?
This is our spare room, basically. I call it spare room. It's a tip. Fortunately, you guys can see the nice part of it. The dogs asleep on the sofa, which is the cute part, but then the rest of it is genuinely a tip of clothes that we're getting rid of, my golf gear. But it's our kind of, yeah, it's our second room. So it's got a sofa bed. So it's the guest room, but this is where we work from home. So tried to put some nice memorabilia in the background just so
good.
That it looks professional every now and then.
Seeing as we both work in motorsport, when we first moved into this apartment, we made a rule collectively. It wasn't just like my rule or his rule, but that this was the only room in the house that we could have anything motorsport related. Otherwise, I think our entire decor would just be.
Yep.
F1, which I'm sure for a lot of people would be like, well, that's a really cool thing to do. But one of the things we've also tried to work really hard on is like boundaries and
yeah,
like
idea.
Cut off from work, considering we both are in the world. So yeah, we've got quite a lot of stuff that is F1 or motorsport related. And the stuff that you can see is the stuff we've managed to hang, and the stuff you can't see is what's on the floor to our right. That is kind of still piling up, but I guess it's one of the perks of the job is that you get to either buy or get hold of some pretty cool stash. So
absolutely.
Yeah, we've got a few cool bits up and about that we've managed to collect over the years.
I particularly like the strategically placed racer magazine by Chris's right ear,
that's got me at trouble at work.
Yeah.
Like just so you know, like that has actually got me in trouble.
The rivalry's already starting.
Yeah, we do work for rival Ooh. Companies. And so I've been doing a live stream on my company's Instagram page with Racer magazine in the background.
Very
and
good.
That did not go down well.
Yeah, your boss told you to dump me because of that.
He did.
Thankfully you didn't. I'm just gutted that you didn't mention the trophies that I've tried to subtly put right in front
of
that.
Yeah, very good, very good. What, so
from karting.
Karting, okay. So
that's
go on.
Even turn round. Right, I'm going to, just 1 second, I'm going to turn one round now.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. That's so subtle, Chris. You're really subtle with the flex there. I love it.
There you go. It's from, so Alpine did a very cool karting championship this year from journalists, and there was 4 rounds. There were trophies for the top 3 in each round and stuff. And I finished 2nd in the championship.
Wow.
With a couple of wins. So
well done, you.
It's my trophies from that. And the one that's actually directly behind me, which I will move for in a sec, is a proper, really fancy glass trophy that they took to the last 2 rounds of the season. And it's so heavy. Yeah. And I was really happy to get it, but getting it into my bag was a nightmare. So
it looks very impressive.
Problems, right?
Well, we'll have to get
hang on. Oh, hold on. Oh, here we go. Tim's that.
Tom,
I want to be involved now.
Tom, I didn't win this, but you'll have to come to our karting event. Tom, I think, has won one of these, haven't you? So we have a biannual, well, not biannual, twice a year we have a karting event. And I think Tom, yeah, he's gone off to get his trophy. I think he got on the podium at the last one. I think Jimmy Broadbent's won it once. And Tom's, what did you come for? Third.
I earned this one, Tim.
Yeah.
I don't get it just because I started the karting event. You can get any one you want, mate.
Yeah, well, whatever. But you should come. You should come along. It's good fun, and the competition's stiff. This year, actually, it was won by a group, a guy called Luke, who invited 4 of his mates who were F2 drivers. So highly unfair. So they won at a canter.
I can get on the podium, anyone can.
True.
Let's be real.
Come on. True.
I was about to say, I kind of dine on the fact that with the media one, we've got some decent carters, but most of them are just for a bit of fun and never get to do it. And there's a massive disparity in carts.
Yes.
So I managed to win the first round because I had the best cart. I nearly beat Oscar Piastri.
Wow.
Because when he overtook me and I was like, well, he'll disappear.
Clang.
I could,
right.
Well, I could stick with him because my cart was so much quicker than a straight line. It was brilliant. So...
Jess, have you done any karting at all?
Yeah, I've done a little bit. We did some in after Abu Dhabi. after the season finale this year. So we've done a bit of stuff, haven't we?
Yeah, that's with Jack Aitken, wasn't it?
Yeah,
who was just kind of manipulating the whole race because racing drivers are really, really good. And you think you're all having this great fight between yourselves and how brilliant everyone's doing, and you realise he's actually just going to the front, slowing everyone down, going to the back, coming back again. He was incredible.
It's frustrating though. I've said this before. Like I went go karting with Max Chilton, and he, you know, Max won't mind me saying, he wasn't a front runner in Formula One, but clearly a very talented racing driver nonetheless. And I tried to follow him and do exactly what he did. And I was taking the curbs like him, and he just disappeared into the distance. They've got this innate talent. I mean, I think weight probably comes into it. He weighs about 3 stone. But
that's always my excuse when I'm slow.
That's the classic, right? The Carter excuse, isn't it? Well, you know,
a bit heavy.
If I was just, you know, a few kilos lighter, I'd have all of you.
Yeah, totally.
But it is magic watching them race. Like one of the, it was actually the Alpine event in 2021 at Abu Dhabi. Fernando Alonso brought his own kart and was doing basically a display of his own. And he was doing donuts and wheelies in a go-kart.
That's impressive.
And the cart control is just insane. And they make it look so easy. And then you jump in, you're like all over the place. You do realize that it does. It's not as easy as it looks.
No, it should
but
be
that
easier.
Is. It's just that little the extra finesse that they've got that just, you know, it makes like tenths, if not seconds, around a cart track. So
it's not fair, quite frankly. Right, back to you two. Chris, let's come to you first. Tell our audience what you do and who you do it for.
I write and talk too much about Formula One.
Anyone who will pay him.
Yeah, fair. Basically, that's how it works.
Wow.
If I'm allowed, the description I quite regularly use is I'm a media whore.
Nice.
It's just, if someone says, here, do this for us, I do it. But no, not quite that bad. I do... Racer magazine and racer.com. I'm their Formula One correspondent, so I do written coverage for them in America mainly. Motorsport magazine, I do their race reports and a weekly column for them on their website, but I also do some features in the magazine and host some of their podcasts. I host a weekly radio show on Sirius XM in the US, plus their pre and post race live coverage. So I do their grid walk and their post race interviews and go and annoy people. This year, annoyed mainly Ted Kravitz and Martin Brundle by getting in the way of their grid walks.
Very good.
And good, then I do a bit of writing for a Japanese website as well. Oh, and Formula1.com. I do about 3 features per race weekend for them that are kind of explaining the basics around what's going on during a race weekend. So things to look out for fans that maybe missed Saturday and are just tuning in for the race or have never watched a Grand Prix before and want to know what they're looking for, or a strategy guide, that sort of thing. So lots of writing and talking and tweeting, basically.
And you're the Fabrizio Romano of F1, right?
Is it according to other people? Please don't
Fabrizio Remedland, that's it. coin it.
And
that's
Jess,
the thing. So and obviously, Jess, what is your kind of equivalent to, like, how similar is what you do to what Chris does?
I would say there is crossover, but it's more of a case of what I do is, so I'm, titled Director of Digital Strategy, but basically we're both storytellers, right, just in different mediums. And what we're trying to do is get across all the stories and all the explainers about what goes on in the crazy world of motorsport. Obviously, a lot of that being F1 led, but I almost like do a bit more of the organization of, like, how do we tell those stories, who is telling those stories, and then on what platform. So a lot of the time that's on YouTube or on social media, and whether that's, you know, I kind of have a team that are making graphics, but I also work with the journalists to be like, okay, like, how are we going to tell this story for the audience to, I guess, best engage with it. Because as we saw even with the team principal silly season that we saw the other day, it's a case of, it can get really complex really, really quickly. So how do I use the brands that I work across, which is Autosport and Motorsport.com, how do I use their insider knowledge, the audience that they speak to, like, how do we then tell that story across multiple things? So Chris is like the doer And I'm almost like the puppet master in the background, kind of moving things around. It's
basically
and
how
then,
things are at home.
Choreographer.
It's like it's a metaphor for your life, I expect. You know, Chris.
Yeah, that's a factor for at home as well. Yeah.
We stay true to type. but no, yeah. And then like, I guess in a weird way as well, like I have a bit of fun on my own social media channels as well. And I've done a bit of presenting. I'm going to be back on F1's Beyond All Limits series, which so sometimes I do take, you know, try and do a bit of journalism myself, if we can call it that. But I think, as I said, at my very core, we're storytellers, and I think that's a really cool thing that we get to do.
I guess you have to move very quickly as well, because with things like the, you know, silly season with the team principals, it's all going to happen very, very fast, and everyone, all the publishers, are trying to publish the news at the same time. Is that one of the challenges that you'll face then on a daily basis, to go, right, we need to rally the troops, let's organise and get this news out quickly?
Yeah, I guess, again, in a way that it's different for Chris and I, is that Chris is a little bit more in control of like how that happens, because he knows, right, I know I need to do this for this client, this for this client. And there's almost like a system that you go through, right? Like you tweet first, and obviously he's first to tweet everything. So and then there's like a system in place, and you know, you're very much as difficult as a one, and I'm talking on behalf of Chris, obviously, but as difficult as a one man band, he knows like kind of like what needs to be done and when. On my side, it is more about, right, okay, how do we pull everything together, and who do I need to put in place to do what to get that out the fastest way possible or in the most efficient way possible. So is that fair to say?
Yes, sir. I don't know about if it's fair on your part, but
yeah, it's a really complex world. I think a lot of people, when they think about Formula One or going into any sport, news, journalism, whatever, I think one of the biggest shocks for them is just how always on you have to be. You know, sometimes if we're lucky, we'll get heads up when stuff's coming, but sometimes that can be like 10 minutes. Sometimes it can be a day. Sometimes it can be a couple of hours. Sometimes not at all. So there's never really like, I think process for us is probably one of the key things that keeps us sane in that, okay, if this scenario happens, regardless of how much lead time we have, this is what we have to do to kind of tackle it. But I think for a lot of people, especially when they're starting out, that's quite a shocker. Like the amount of times we've been in service station car parks, like on the way to somewhere, something drops. That means everything else in our life stops, and we have to kind of tackle it. So especially Chris, because yeah, he, like I said, he's on his own. But
well, as a more recent example about the team principal silly season, this is a proper first world problem as well. But I was like aware of what was coming for most of it from the night before, so I was up in time and had stuff prepped and ready. But then you're reacting to the actual content that comes out, what's said, what the real detail is that's on there that you maybe don't know yet. And then the Andreas Seidel stuff was I didn't know was coming there and then at that point. And that caught me out a little bit, and I had to sort of chase it that morning. But I had a golf lesson booked in that morning. I confirmed it the night before because of the weather, it was freezing and stuff. I was like, yeah, I'll definitely be there. And there's a time I had to leave, and I suddenly realized I was waiting, time's getting closer. I was like, this might not get announced before I need to leave. So I spoke to McLaren again, and I was like, look, I'm going to be out of action like this window. And I'm hearing that that's probably a bad time to be out of action. They're like, yeah, it is, essentially. I'm like, can I get it? And this sometimes works or is offered anyway. But I was like, can I get the release in advance so I can have it prepped and ready and I can hit send when I'm there? And they're like, no, basically, like we've kept this so tight. It's not been something that's leaked until today sort of thing. And, we're not allowed to release anything to anyone in advance. So they gave me the time at least. And it meant that I still went to the golf lesson because it was too late and I was going to lose the money if I didn't go. But then I had to say to the guy, I'm really sorry, but I've got to stop now and get my phone out and tweet. And then I'd already written basically most of the story, and I needed to add the quotes and check the facts. And then I could do on my phone, I could add that in and send the copy over to a racer in the US. And we had a guy who's UK based who was picking up the copy. So my golf instructor was he found it really fascinating and very interesting. And I found it almost like I was cheating a bit because I was stood in the middle of a golf driving range, freezing, by the way. I made so many typos because my fingers wouldn't work. But yeah, I spent, so basically about a quarter of the actual lesson was spent with me working. But that's, in a sense, the good thing. You can do that. You can grab your phone if you prep things and have drafts ready. But the flip side is, it's the bad thing. You can't ever escape it. You can't, if you've got your phone on you, you're never off duty. And there are other scenarios where you didn't ask for that or prep for that, and you have to respond. And yeah, it can be a bit draining at times, because they're meant to be those moments that are, you know, a bit of downtime, a bit of switch off time.
Yeah.
And you don't always get to enjoy them. But proper first world moment, that one.
So when it comes to like breaking news, and working with the teams, like you say, you spoke to McLaren in that instance. Do you have collectively, is there a close relationship between people like yourselves and the teams? And are some teams more kind of open with you than others, I suppose? Or is it just, is it like an industry standard as such?
No, you're spot on. There's some teams that you've got great relationships with and others that you have terrible ones with. And by terrible, I mean like non-existent, not that it's negative. Sometimes it can be a bit negative based on maybe something you've written or something that's happened before. Fortunately, I don't think I have any of those. But as an example, like Ferrari are very hard to get anything out of. Or if you ask them stuff, you might not get a reply for a long time, partly because they get so much globally kind of interest and request that you sometimes just don't get seen if you send them an email or send them a message or your timing's bad. With others, you maybe just have spent a bit more time with them or worked with them before. For example, the head of comms at McLaren used to be at Williams, has been in the industry a lot longer. You sort of done different work with her at different points. But then, for example, at Haas, their head of comms, very good with me because Haas wanting US audience kind of interaction, I can offer that. So it does also depend on the viewpoint. I remember standing doing radio stuff, waiting for Mattia Binotto a few times this year and being shunted back and back and back in the queue, even though I was there ready to interview him live, because I didn't have a TV camera, I was only radio. And they had to prioritize first Italian media, which was understandable, but then TV. And they do it to the extent that I wasn't allowed to interview him until Sky Italia had interviewed him, because they couldn't show up and have to wait. That wasn't going to be allowed. Mm. So even though he was stood around waiting and I was free and we could have got it done and I could have left, I was, you know, you see where you are in their pecking order. So that's where sometimes those relationships can be different as well. And in terms of an industry standard, I wish there was one, but it's fair enough. That's a big part of this job, that whenever people ask me for certain advice about being a journalist, at least, I would say one of the biggest things to be is like honest and legitimate and authentic. Because if you're not a real person that someone can engage with and can kind of learn to trust or can get on with, or at least know where they stand with, very quickly people see through it that you just want something out of them, that you're digging for info, whatever it may be. And if you don't have a good relationship with someone, then you're not going to get to any of that information, or you're not going to get very far.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you spend so much time, and people are, you know, it's a brilliant job to do, but people are so committed to work in this industry. You do need to have a good rapport with people, and actually, you know, it's just too tiring to be fake.
Yeah. So I guess those sort of soft skills are something that people don't necessarily think about when they're choosing a career in journalism. I mean, I speak to a lot of young people about motorsport and how to get into it. And they're great when you're talking to them on LinkedIn or you're having a chat through email. And, you know, they can be very good writers. And then you meet them face to face and they can't hold a conversation. I suppose that's a bit of a deal breaker for a career such as yours, where relationships are key. And like you say, with race teams, it's important. Does the same apply to drivers? I'd imagine that you have to build up a certain rapport with the drivers in the paddock if you want to approach them and get that great quote. So I suppose that sort of team relationship extends to the drivers, and you have the same kind of, not issues, but needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can tell quite often when you do get an interview with someone about how, you know, almost basic some of the responses can be, like they've gone through them a million times, which drivers do. I've done TV pen work before in the past, and you've seen them go around the pen and they're getting asked the same two or three questions and they're refining the answer in the first two or three goes. And then by the time they're on the fourth kind of TV crew, they are saying the exact same thing over and over again, because they've worked out exactly what it is that they want to say and how best to say it. And when you then get other avenues where maybe I run over to them with a mic walking down the paddock post-race or something on the grid, and that is when that relationship comes into it. You know, are they willing to talk or not? Daniel Ricciardo, for example, at his final race in Abu Dhabi, wasn't on the grid. Like, the timing didn't quite work out, and I missed him a couple of times that had been lined up. And then when I could get him walking back from the national anthem, he was trying to get in the zone, and he was like, you know, just kind of waved me off politely, but was like, no, not right now. But because I'd done that, I then got him after the race, and he was great, because he was like, yeah, I appreciate you didn't hound me or stick the mic in my face when I said no. You know, it's give and take. You know, obviously I need or want something from them, but that doesn't mean it's at all costs. So yeah, if you don't try and build that relationship up as well and just kind of put yourself in their shoes sometimes, it can hurt. So yeah, from my perspective, I've always found that stuff been very important.
Yeah, and like from a content, I was going to ask you, Jess, in terms of, I know the Ferrari stuff you did more recently with Carson Chagall, you know, you get a different perspective, I guess, when you're approaching drivers through a different lens, a less kind of, you know, obviously there's a time and a place to ask the classic questions of a driver, what did you make of the race, blah, blah, blah. But also now, I think more than ever, and I'm sure you've both seen the change over the last kind of even just 5 years, that there's this, all of a sudden there's this window into, everyone wants to see the drivers as human beings, not just as, you know, names above a racing car.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of maybe a slight point of difference between what I do and what Chris does. Like, I think Chris has written some really amazing features about drivers where I think you do get that same sense. But I think, again, they're all mainly to do with what's going on track and maybe a little bit about what they've done away from track. But there's a bit more of a, I don't want to say proper, because that kind of devalues what maybe some of the things that I do, and I don't think they're any less important. But yeah, oftentimes I'm coming with that viewpoint of like, who are you as an individual? And to do that, you really have to get them to trust you, because they are, especially when we're in a racing scenario, they're conditioned by their press officer. Like, you say this and you think this of the team and this is allowed and this isn't. And you're almost trying to break that down a little bit and get them to relax and get them to trust you. And that can be quite tricky when you're asking them to, I don't know, do something that might be considered slightly silly or would put them on the back foot. But then actually, like, some of the content that you get that sits alongside the more traditional stuff is really interesting, and kind of gets a completely different viewpoint. But like, I've worked with Charles and Carlos a lot, and I think, at least I can't talk on Carlos's side, but Charles, like, I have quite a good relationship with him, and so when he walks onto set, and he's, what I want is when any driver walks onto set and sees me and they know me, for them to go, okay, it's going to be all right. Like, I kind of know what to expect. It's not going to be something that's going to put me on the back foot or whatever. And I think that's always been the aim. Like, I used to say at WTF1, I want them to see our name on the kind of the press sheet for the day, and to go, actually, I'm looking forward to that one, because I know that that's going to be something that's either slightly different or about them as people, rather than why were you 0.3 slower than your teammate, which is oftentimes what they're getting asked in the more traditional sense, that can kind of like, well, like, yeah, like Chris said, like, it has to be asked, but they're getting asked that by everybody. So how do you get that point of difference that tells a different story, a different side of them, and allows them to be people, not just drivers?
Yeah, and I suppose it's a balancing act as well, because, you know, take WTF1 is a good example. It's a very different sort of, much more sort of cutting edge, I suppose, approach to motorsport journalism in some regards. But I guess you've got to be wary of doing something different that the drivers go, look at WTF1 and go, no, I've got to do something daft, panic, you know, it's not me. So I suppose it's a real balancing act, isn't it?
There was always a line, and I think I carried that through to, because one of the things that I did when I first joined the network was I had two brands to work with, like Autosport, which has this amazing legacy. You know, it's been there since the very first Grand Prix. It's got obviously a very loyal certain type of fan base. So, you know, it's doing its thing over here. And then I had another one, which was motorsport.com, that kind of didn't really have the same footprint. It was newer. It's only been around since 1994. But that also opened up an avenue for me to maybe bring more of that perspective that I'd had when I was at WTF1 onto that side of what was then considered just to be, I guess, mainly just a news outlet, but didn't have that kind of brand loyalty. So, but there's definitely, as you say, like there's a, what I've been very, very clear to do is say, you know, we're not silly, but we can have fun. Yeah. And I think that's the difference, in that everybody can have a laugh and everybody can talk about things that are, you know, not so serious, but you don't ever want to have them, go like, I'm not doing that. Like, that would be the absolute worst case scenario for me, was if I ever was working with a driver and they refused to do something because they just didn't, they just thought it was below them or it was not the right thing to do. So, and luckily I can say I've never had that happen. So, so that's, but yeah, I think that's the difference. Like there's a line, and as long as you're really strong and sure in terms of what is, brand safe and what's not, then you should be okay. You can kind of have a bit of fun.
A very quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsors at F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first-class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including driver appearances, private pit lane walks, behind-the-scenes tours of the illustrious F1 paddock, team garages, the famous podium, and loads more. It's the closest you can get to Formula One. And thanks to F1 Experiences, Motormouth listeners can get 5% off your next F1 Experiences package by using the code MMPODCAST when booking online at F1Experiences.com.
So what do we think the kind of future holds with this space? Because one thing I think is quite interesting, say, let's look ahead 10 years, right? And most of the F1 grids, in 10 years' time will be different. There'll be people who are, you know, kids nowadays and possibly watching, whether it's Autosport, whether it's WTF1, whether it's Reading Racer, whether it's watching my stuff, whether it's listening to this podcast. You know, I feel like in 10 years' time, the drivers will be so much more used to this space existing, I guess, beyond the traditional journalistic front. How do you two see the sport changing in the next 5-10 years, just not just in terms of driver acceptance of, like you say, just the more kind of fun stuff, the more lighthearted, the more social media centric stuff, but also just the space as a whole, I suppose, because for you, Chris, obviously you're coming from a more traditional journalistic background, but that still has a place. And I guess it's kind of allowing both sides to work, because the F1 fan base, you've got some fans who want to get really delved into the details and other fans who just like drivers as personalities and characters.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite funny you should say I'm coming from a more traditional background, which I am. But at the same time, when I started out and was working at ESPN, like online media weren't getting accredited to F1 races. Like the internet was still being kind of blocked out, and you had to be a print publication or a broadcaster. And then, yeah, so we really struggled to get accredited. And then once we started getting in, that was sort of 2011, 2012, 2013 time. And it was about 2013 and it opened up more. But then you'd get in and social media was still being shunned at that point. You know, you couldn't tweet. Even teams weren't allowed to sort of tweet photos or videos or whatever. It was so slow catching up in that sense that I felt like I was kind of at the forefront of the, as in, not that I led it or anything, but I was part of, my timing was lucky, the change towards, okay, a lot more online-centric stuff and opening it up to a much bigger audience that way. And then social media being much more welcomed. Now we can do little bits at the track that never used to be allowed before.
Still massively restricted.
Yeah, it is. But it's things like we can do little bits of filming as long as it's, you know, not including a team or something. But I can film myself for Racer for a couple of minutes every day in the paddock if I want, just to show you there and add some value. And I think that will evolve quite quickly. I think it will be the way that the, at the moment, it's the broadcast deals that kind of restrict it, because as TV and radio companies pay so much money and get to define exactly what it is that they then want from that, that then has the knock-on effect of, okay, well, then that's what's left for online, social, print, whatever it is. And I think as TV companies start opening up and going, okay, actually, this kind of supplementary content helps us, more people get into the sport this way, then I think there'll be a little bit more of an opening for other content creators to do some more kind of unique, different, original stuff. But I think a lot of it will kind of remain similar in the sense that the aim will be, how do you, and I'm going to steal one of Jess's own terms here from her, but she talks about like a funnel of getting people interested in F1. And it's, how do you get as many people interested as possible? But in a sense, the way you're going to monetize certain key areas are people that are fully invested, like that are really, really keen in the sport, really interested. They want to pay for their Sky Sports subscription, or they want to pay for their Autosport subscription, or Racer Magazine, whatever it may be. So you have to get people to a certain point where they're going to part with money for a lot of this stuff, that they've got that level of interest. And I think it does mean that actually a lot of the core pillars will remain the same. for certain outlets and what they offer. It's just going to be the way they get to offer it that might change a little bit. And then also platforms. I mean, there's no way, even 5 years ago, we probably wouldn't talk about TikTok. Mm. I'm still so backwards that I don't have a TikTok account, really.
I'm trying to convince him. Tom, have you not got one?
No.
It's inevitable. Okay. It's inevitable.
All right, okay. No, I think, but you know what? I think actually that's totally fine, because I think when the temptation always is that we have to be on every platform all at once, all the time. And actually, I think as things explode, there is I think, an innate need to then distill and actually become experts in a certain thing. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think actually that's kind of where I was going to go, because I totally agree with what Chris just said. But I actually think what will open up is that there will be almost niches within the niche. So one thing that we haven't really seen in F1, like I remember, again, not to keep talking about kind of past things, but WTF1, we just put up a video about what a steering wheel does, an F1 steering wheel. It was an old one. It was a 2012 F1 steering wheel that did like 2 million views on YouTube, because no one had ever put up a video about what an F1 steering wheel had done. We did a video on pit stops and how they differ across motorsport series. That did another like 2 million views. Now, every team's done a steering wheel video. We've covered the basics. So the only way now that people are going to grow is to actually find niches and actually find, okay, this is my area of this big topic that I can then make my own. And that will work. That will be the same for brands as well. You know, like I always say, so Autosport focuses on news, tech, analysis. So that is their three pillars. That's what they focus on. Motorsport.com focuses on culture, lifestyle, as well as kind of news and updates. But you know, it's as interested about what goes on off track as it is on track. So there's going to be, and you know, that's still quite broad. There might be people that are totally and only interested in what fashion is worn in the paddock. And that will be a niche, and that will have its own audience. So I think there's going to be almost like areas opening up and niches opening up within. I mean, we're only talking about Formula One as well. Like there's so much untapped potential in places like WEC, MotoGP. You know, the thing that actually blew my mind was Chris asked me a few months ago, did I know anyone that was a MotoGP influencer? There are none. Like.
And that is huge,
right? It's massive, and that again has to do with the level of access that I think content creators can get with MotoGP, which has maybe been a bit of a, you know, you can't help but watch F1's meteoric rise in terms of popularity and people wanting to buy in and get interested in it and create content and that everything like that. But MotoGP's kind of not had that same movement. But the idea that there's this major international racing series that has no influencers, that I just, how can that
mad.
Even be?
It is mad. It's a bit like with something like WEC or Le Mans, you know, the Le Mans 24 hour, one of the greatest race on the planet in many people's eyes, you know, a feat of human and mechanical endurance. And again, you don't really get anyone for honing in on the World Endurance Championship like you do Formula One. It's interesting what you say about the funnel. I want, because with the whole Netflix effect with Drive to Survive and those sort of armchair fans who have come in via that that platform, I wonder where they'll sit in the funnel in terms of monetization and spending their money. You know, whether they'll just sit at the top of the funnel and not quite get into it from a spend perspective.
It's amazing though how lucrative that top of funnel is, because they're the people that will buy merch. They're
yes,
the people 100%. That will like that they're buying.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Into the lifestyle and the culture of F1, they might never ever go to a Formula One race in their life. But actually, I mean, the last time I did a fan survey, I think we surveyed an audience. I think it might have been WTF ones, probably. But like, I think not 65% of the audience had never been to a Formula One race in their life. And I think that is to do with the nature of Formula One, right? I mean, if you're based in Europe, you're lucky that you have quite a few races that you can choose to go to. But even then,
it's expensive.
At least, you know, yeah, one of them, it might be in your home country, not even like hometown or, you know, like close by. I mean, Silverstone, for a lot of people in the UK, is the arse end of nowhere, right? And it's expensive to stay there, or you have to camp or whatever. So the actual logistics of Formula One make it very difficult to actually attend a race unless you are lucky enough to be able to travel. So those top of funnel people that kind of want to be involved in it actually have like massive economic weight in the sport, because they will buy into the easy to get stuff, which is merchandise, which is following these influencers, or what, you know, wanting to be part of the world, or creating their own UGC, or so it's I totally agree in terms of what F1 and what the broadcasters are going to want is that funnel down. But that's not to negate the people at the top, because they wield a lot of power.
Yeah. But it's not just that as well. For a lot of them, so obviously everyone comes in from the top. So a bunch of them do still filter down, you know, and wherever people then end up is completely fine. It's up to them. You don't, it's not like, oh, you're not a proper fan because you didn't go all the way to the bottom of the funnel or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I count myself as something similar when it comes to other sports. I do it with like baseball in the US.
Yeah,
I've got how many, 3 Cubs jerseys?
Well, yeah, he has a whole cupboard in this room that just have like sports jerseys. And there was one day, like I think the Warriors won the
NBA championship when we were in Montreal. Yeah,
and he was immediately on his phone looking at what like special edition jersey they were going to do. Like, have you seen them play a couple times? Is that right?
Yeah, I've been to a few games. And with all these, I've been to games, but obviously it's a lot easier because there's more. And if you do go to the States and you're in that city, they're playing pretty much every day or something. Yeah, you do get the opportunities in that way. But I follow it from afar. Baseball's more the example I use, but basketball would work just as well, where I don't know the nuances of the sport. Like, I don't watch it and I can't really understand, like I can with, say, football or something. Like, when a team's playing well, why, or certain aspects or certain duels. But I still am really passionate about the end result and the gear.
Yeah, we went to see the Cubs play when we were in Chicago. Like there is a way of being a fan without needing to know. And this is what always pisses me off, because somebody asked me about like, oh, well, you know, the 2012, Brazil 2012, like obviously a big race, but I was like, I can't remember what happened. And there are some people that just have like encyclopedic levels of knowledge. Yeah. Like I've got a girl on my team, Laura, who literally, like her level of knowledge of the history of Formula One is incredible. But I don't think that then discounts my level of knowledge or my understanding or my appreciation for it. It just means that
She's got a better long-term memory. That's literally
100%.
It. You should be punished for that.
Exactly, right? But I saw something the other day as well, because obviously one of the things that's cropped up in recent years is like the influx of female fans. And I mean, F1 has always been a sport, I feel, that has had a lot of gatekeepers. Not even recently. Like, it's just always been that way. That there's almost like this level of snobbery in terms of what counts. Like, oh, you like F1. Well, prove it, well, you know, name 3 of their songs kind of thing, like approach to it. Do you know what I mean? And it feels like it's gotten worse because of the social media aspect of it, and you can see it happening rather than just experiencing it for yourself. But you know, we've seen like female fans maybe experience or enjoy or are interested in different aspects of Formula One from say male fans, or, you know, fans that have been watching it for decades rather than the past few years. But there was a study, I remember someone sent me a study whereby they were talking about how men as fans tend to want to absorb like every single piece of information that they can. They almost collect information. And that is their, that's their way of expressing fandom. Whereas women seem to be less inclined to do that. They connect on a different level. And it's interesting to see or to think about that, because when you look at the gatekeeping that's going on, a lot of it, or like F1 fans tend to, which is still predominantly male dominated in terms of its fandom, as well as in the industry itself. They tend to approach it and be like, well, what happened? Canada 2007 corner three, tell me what happened. Yeah. Like, that's how you prove that you're a fan. And I think that that is, that's quite sad because, well, one, it's sad because, I mean, if you know that, like, it's, that's a very granular level of detail. I'm not even sure you would know. Do you know what happened?
Which lap?
which second of the race? No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But that's the beauty of Formula One, is that there are so many aspects to enjoy. I mean, you know, Tom's one of those guys who's very good at picking up knowledge from different eras. I've tested you before. And, you know, going back to sort of 2014.
Try my best, Tim.
Pluck something out of your head. For me, I love the business of Formula One. I like the commercial aspects of it. It's become my career, you know, the whole sponsorship side of things, which is a fascinating industry in its own right. You know, there's so many different things to get involved with. And you mentioned there about women in motorsport, and it's something we wanted to touch on. And there's a lot going on at the moment. There's the more than equal stuff that Coulthard and Kate Bevan are involved with. We've had W Series come and probably go. We've got the new Formula One Academy that's launching soon. There are things happening. But do you think, both of you, do you think we're doing enough for women in motorsport? And then second part of the question, does Jamie Chadwick deserve a shot at F1?
I'll go with the second part of the question first, just because it's a bit easier to answer and quicker to answer, is that she might, but she's still so far down the ladder to be able to make that call. I mean, you know, going into Indy Lights, or Indy Next as they're now calling it, I'd still, like, it's a good category, but it would have been like her going into Formula 3. And there's not a driver in, like, heading into what would be their rookie Formula 3 season next year that I'd say they deserve to be in F1. They might in the future. They can maybe prove themselves. Similarly, the way Nyck de Vries has gone around getting to Formula 1, when he came out of Formula 2, I didn't think he was ready for an F1 seat, or kind of, you know, I wasn't that gutted that he didn't get one. I kind of thought, I don't know if he really shines enough to get ahead of anyone else on the grid right now. But what he's done since, and the more rounded driver he's become at a much later age into his mid-late 20s, then, yeah, absolutely deserving. So I think that could be potentially in future. I certainly don't think it should be that people try and judge her now. I think it's a bit too unfair to do it with what she's had in terms of experience. But I don't think motorsport in general, and certainly not single-seater junior categories of motorsport, are doing anywhere near enough. And it's great that more are doing it now. But what really annoyed me on this front was the discussion around the F1 category that they've put together. Because people were saying, oh, you know, they should have just helped W Series. They should just give money to W Series. It was already there. And it's like, why do people think that all it needs is one single category to try and help a group of probably 18 female drivers? And that will fix the problem. How many young men get to go racing and have opportunities and seats in cars that, you know, that suit them, fit them, are designed for them? Because that's another thing, kind of like the physiological differences mean that there's a lot of cockpits that just are not kind of compatible for women to have, you know. And we're only talking small things, but motorsport is done in small details. The differences are, especially in spec series that then have differences in teams and what they can produce, you are looking for the smallest gain. And if just not being comfortable in the car or able to do certain things in the car, like, it's such a big disadvantage. But then to say, oh, okay, as long as one category is trying to change that, you're at best going to get maybe one standout driver from that group of 18, which would be a hell of a hit rate to have one standout driver from such a small pool that then has to step up to a category full of much more experienced and well-prepared male drivers and say, go on, shine. And when they don't, go, oh, well, it proves they can't do it and that category is not good enough to supply them. It's the complete wrong mindset. What we need is to try and find a way of making it as many opportunities to get as many women in cars as possible, and then make sure that that doesn't get too high up the ladder so you don't segregate all the way up. And that they can then step into something like Formula 3 or even at Formula 2 level. And you've got 3, 4, 5 women that are more than capable of going in there. And if one of them does well, then they're going to be maybe winning a championship at F3 and F2. They're going to get to F1. But there feels like it's just, they're just looking for one Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen-esque figure.
Yeah.
Like, how rare are they even when you've got thousands and thousands of men doing it? And then from that point, it's like, well, then what happens afterwards? And I think Jess maybe speaks a bit better about this than I do, but just getting one female driver into an F1 car for one race, are people going to view it as, oh, good, job done? Like, you know, what happens next?
So. Yeah. But it's an education thing, isn't it? Because, you know, that's very articulately put. And I wholeheartedly agree with everything you've just said. The trouble is you jump onto Twitter or LinkedIn and you see the name Jamie Chadwick or Alice Powell even, or, you know, there is a few, you know, at that kind of level. And the chat on Twitter is, why isn't she in an F1 seat? She should be in an F1 seat. You know, why hasn't this happened yet? There's nobody outside of people in the industry who are giving that balanced view. It just feels like just stick her in a car and then, you know, job done.
I think that's to do with, again, maybe going a bit macro here, but there's this societal need for instantaneous change. As in, like,
yeah,
it just needs to happen now. Like, W Series has failed because it hasn't produced a F1 driver. And it's like, well, that's not actually how it works. We're trying to repair decades, if not, you know, this motorsport came about from rich men racing around in cars. It was like, it wasn't even really a proper, I'm going to get killed for saying this, it wasn't like a proper sport. It was like, it was genuinely just something for them to do on the weekends, right? You would buy a car, you'd take it racing, and then all of a sudden it became this more nuanced thing of, oh, actually, you know, this could turn into a proper thing and we could run it professionally. And then you got like the bodies, the governing bodies are kind of emerging and it became a proper outfit. But, you know, it was never meant or made with female racing drivers in mind. And so what we're trying to do here is kind of take it back to basics, which is what I think I and Chris and I have had many a debate around this topic. Obviously, I have a slightly different viewpoint on certain things, but I think for the most part, we agree in that it's not going back far enough. It's not like, you know, we're setting up a series for junior racing drivers, but they're still like fairly old in comparison to who they would then be going up against in terms of when they were meant to go back from the segregated series into a mixed series. And they also have a lot less seat time because W Series only races X number of times a year. And if you like, you know, I know Jamie Chadwick had been able to probably primarily through the funding that she's won through W Series and obviously certain backers to be able to arrange private testing. But for the most part, those girls can't do that. And so if we're going to compare apple and oranges, like you're talking about drivers that have had so much more single seater seat time competing against these female drivers, and I really hate using the term female drivers, but here we are. I guess we do need to kind of differentiate if we're going to be talking about this, but that haven't. And you're asking them to be the same, or you're asking them to be competitive. Like that would never, if we were just comparing two male drivers and saying this person, I mean, we get it all the time, right? Pay drivers tend to get far and are semi-decent at least because they can afford to have that seat time, to have that those private tests, to get the sponsors, to pay for the seats. Like it is still, at the end of the day, it's a sport driven by money. Mm. And the conversations that I've had, so Chris and I were lucky enough to go out to the States in the summer, and we went to the Skip Barber Racing School and we did a 3-day Formula 4 test, both him and I. And there were certain things that kind of popped up for me that weren't the same for you
on arrival.
So, you know, when we arrived, there was a group of about 12 of us, was there? About 12, maybe more, of students who were going to be taking part in the same test. There was one other woman, and she was just there for a jolly, really. Like she wasn't, it was a bit of fun for 3 days or whatever. And when I turned up to the registration desk, the girl behind the desk was like, "Oh, and are you watching?"
Wow.
Like, no, I'm here to take part. And as soon as I said that, she was like, "Oh God, amazing! Right, okay." Like, but it was the assumption was, "Oh, I'm here to watch him."
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And there was stuff like they didn't have kits small enough for me, so my helmet was too big. So when we were, you know, when we got up to like pushing top, so, well, we were limited in the cars, but when we were pushing like top speed, my helmet was lifting. Like when we were going down the straights, like, and that's so distracting because you're all of a sudden you're not focusing on where's my braking point. You're focusing on, am I going to, is my helmet going to come off?
Yeah.
So there was stuff like that. You know, they didn't have any racing boots small enough for me. We just about got a race suit small enough for me. Obviously, the cockpit in the car, these are all stock Formula 4 cars. I had to have special padding put in. I mean, some of the other guys did too, but I had to have a lot because my legs were too short and my hips were too big. So I was kind of rattling around the cockpit in one way and then stuck and quite uncomfortable in others. So it was, even that was, you know, a 3-day experience, but even then it was like, this isn't built for me. I don't belong here.
But to your point about going further back, you know, even when I look at the karting events that we do, so we have a lot of girls that come to the karting events and they need the back support, the seat inserts. Even with the seat inserts, that doesn't do the job. They still, some of them are still struggling to reach the pedals. And as you say, they're walking around in these baggy old race suits because they're all designed for blokes. The helmets don't fit. And that's at karting level, you know, that and corporate karting, you know, so it's a huge task, isn't it?
But I'm sorry, if Alpine can develop a car that works with Esteban Ocon, who's about 17 foot tall, and Fernando Alonso, who's like the next tidiest to Yuki Tsunoda, there is not an excuse. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. That's the thing, there isn't an excuse, but the people don't look at it. And then they go, as Jess was saying about where money's involved or needed to get people through. I know some people then level the argument like, well, if someone would just put all the money behind one female driver, or sorry, basically one girl who hasn't even been karting yet and says, you know, get in a go-kart, we'll give you all the time in the world, and you know, with time and experience, you'll get good. But it's like, but no one will do that because they know all the way along that road towards whichever pinnacle that you want to target, there are obstacles that are unfairly slanted against women. And as you've just said about the way that certain things don't fit, or the gear that they've got, or the car just not being quite suited to them in terms of, you know, some of the power steering stuff, which you don't need by the time you reach Formula One. Like, it's pointless, but it's a roadblock on the way. And Anthony Davidson, I did a podcast with him on Motorsport Magazine, who did he really explained it well. He said he felt disadvantaged getting into a Formula One car back in the mid-2000s because he knew he was quicker, like it's on skill, than most of the drivers that he'd been competing with. But physically, with his size, because he was small and he wasn't like bulky up top, he was fatiguing towards the end of races, and he retired from a few where he made mistakes and crashed out, or genuinely just had to almost park it. And he said he felt like it shouldn't be that way. Like, it shouldn't come down to how much can I lift in the gym. It's how can I basically find the quickest way around a racetrack. They're two different things. And he says if he had it on his level, you can't imagine what it's like for a lot of women. And so you're not going to get people put all the money behind them and give them those opportunities, because they know, in a sense, it's not sensible money if you've got, you know, 2% less chance, because they all add up as small things. But that's a gamble that then you put the money behind a guy because he's got 2% more chance.
Yeah.
That's why it happens that way.
It's go on, Tom.
This is why you can't measure the success or failure of something like W Series on whether they got a driver to F1. It's the unknown effect. In 10 years' time, is there going to be someone, a young girl coming up who watched W Series and that was the route in it? It's changing the attitudes, isn't it? It's like your experience, Jess, turning up to that event. That it's not even a malicious thing. It's just this expectation that, oh, it's motorsport, so it's going to be predominantly male. In terms of like other, I don't know, like nursing, for example, when it's when the nurse isn't a woman, you would say a male nurse, because there's expectation, and it's not necessarily it's not born of individual malice necessarily. Sometimes it is, don't get me wrong, but I just think it's this expectation that needs to change. And it's like you get to a stage where, you know, at the MotorMouth karting event, so the team I was on, where we got third place, was I was the only male on the team. And I was chatting to the girls there, and they were saying that, you know, I think it's between 90 or 95%. I think it's more like 95% of racing licenses are held by males. Mm-hmm. And it's like, when you've got that such a smaller pool, and you've got this assumption that if you're of a certain gender, you're going to be either into motorsport or not, that will only change over time. There's not that, like you say, like a quick one-off solution.
Yeah. Even now, so I got asked by a pretty high profile person in Formula One at Abu Dhabi, so are you actually into motorsport? Like, when did you get into it? And it's like, no guy would have that asked of them. Maybe it would be because I love people's Genesis stories, because I actually think it's really it's really cool. And you will find, like, usually there's a story about a family member or a friend or something is quite like, there's a very, origin stories of how people got into motorsport tend to be really lovely stories. And so I don't mind talking about that, but you know that it's not being asked. And actually they prefaced it with, can I ask you a rude question?
Oh God. But Jess,
and you're like,
Jess, this is the tip of the iceberg for women in motorsport, because so this is an area we're going to be, as a podcast, we're focusing on quite a lot over the next few weeks. The reason being, and Tom will be bored of me talking about this, but we had Arianna Bravo on the show a few weeks ago. And much like we've done in this conversation, we were talking about, quote, females. And we were having a conversation. And then I got called out on Twitter for using the word female. So there's this whole new other part of it about, you know, how we describe people and their genders and what words are derogatory and what words are not. And so we're going to be getting really deep into these subjects around not just women in motorsport, but how people talk about women in motorsport. So that's one part of it. And should we be referencing them as females or women or something else entirely? But there's also pieces around not just, you know, guys coming up to you in the paddock and being like, come on, are you really interested in motorsport, Jess? You know, what's this? But it goes well beyond that into, you know, women and girls that work, whether they're, you know, PRs in marketing, they're engineers, whatever position they are in the paddock, they're getting abuse in some cases. And it could be verbal, it could be something else, but there are real problems that need to be addressed. And I've spoken to someone who's been in motorsport for 20 years, very recently, a woman, and she says it's still going on. She's like, the stuff I could tell you about people who are big in motorsport who really shouldn't be doing certain things. So there's a lot, it's such a complicated subject, and we could go on for hours and hours and hours. We've already gone over time. So we're going to have, as always, Tom, we've got through about 1/10 of what we were aiming to get through.
That's when you know the chat's good.
Yeah, it's good chat.
We've just talked about you the whole time.
Yeah.
it's fascinating stuff, and we won't keep you for too much longer. But there is a final three questions that we ask all of our guests, and they come from our friends and sponsors at F1 Experiences. And listeners, don't forget, go to f1experiences.com, buy your products, enter MM Podcast on your checkout, and you'll get your 5% discount. Tom, why don't you kick off with the first one this week?
Sure. So question one, and this maybe could be individually or collective. What's got you most excited at the moment?
At the moment?
Is it the off season?
Christmas. You're
finally free.
Yeah. Time off, which isn't fully time off as well, because you can't switch the internet off and there's a lot of work that still needs doing, but it's nice to be on a more normal kind of schedule in one place.
Like not jumping on a plane.
Yeah,
and just kind of being able to build in things that are personal time.
Basically, this is the period of time where we go and see people that don't work in Formula One and we're like, hi, we exist. and I like, it's so good to see you. Please catch me up in your entire year.
Yeah.
Like I was at a baby shower for one of my friends last weekend, and I've literally not seen her for ages. So there's that stuff, which is really nice. Obviously, like seeing family and things. I think it's the same for a lot of people around this time of year. But
planning a wedding, it's quite exciting.
Yeah, yes. Planning our wedding.
Right. Plug for myself here.
Go for it.
If you need a wedding bar, we have one. It's
okay.
It's Sylvian Squires. The bar's called Sybil. She's a beautiful 3-berth horse box with a bar.
You're
inside.
Shameless, Tim. And so shameless.
I'm just saying, I'll send you the deets. And
yeah, do it.
She's amazing. I would be your barman, of course. And my wife, Chloe, is a wedding stylist. So, you know, we've got you sorted. So,
there we go. You know, all right.
Plug over.
Okay, we can take our foot off the gas on that one then.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the Motormouth Wedding Special. Yeah.
Yes.
Live stream. Love it.
Live stream. Okay, good. So essentially you're looking forward to normality, a bit of downtime.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know that feels like I feel like a lot of people complain. We love what we do, but it's just, it's so nice when it's so full on, like to just get those little,
it's hard work. It's non-stop, you know, it's full on. To both of you, let's go to you first, Jess. How much of your success do you put down to luck and right place, right time? And how much do you put down to damn right hard work?
So I used to struggle with imposter syndrome a lot. And so, and a big sign of imposter syndrome is just putting everything down to luck and going, oh, it wasn't me. It was just, this happened and here I am. But I think there has to be a point in time where that stuff happens more and more. It is not coincidence. There must be something that you're doing that's right. So I think opportunities coming up right place, right time is definitely a big part. But I think that's the reason those opportunities have arose is because people know who I am. They've seen me work. They trust me. They want to work with me. And I've been really lucky in that for most of my jobs, I haven't actually had to interview. I've been approached and headhunted. So yes, it's good. And a couple of the times people have approached me and I'm like, excuse me? Like, sorry, is there not somebody else you want to talk to about this? But so I think it's definitely a mixture of things, but also I guess when you're starting out really early on and maybe you don't have that same footprint, it's about like you have to be ruthless in terms of what are you passionate about? What do you believe in? And how hungry really are you? And I think that's a big thing because so many people talk to me or message me and say, I want to work in F1. And my question back sometimes is actually, but do you really? Because it's not for everyone. I've actually worked with a number of people who, I've had this recently where somebody on my team actually quit because they were just like, look, I love motorsport. I love this world, but working in it is actually ruining my enjoyment of my passion. So, yeah, and that was a really big thing for them to do. So I think you've got to have hunger. You have to be good at what you do in order for those opportunities and that luck to arise. So I would say like, I would like to think it's about 75% hard work and the rest luck and timing. But I'm a big believer in everything happens for a reason, but I think you have to give the reason for it to happen. Yeah. So
I could probably make it shorter then based on that. But I'd say that the luck part was at the very start, was getting in the door, was that first opportunity.
But that was from hustle. Sorry, that was hustle.
You get there, you know, you put yourself in the best position for it.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of very good people that just, you know, maybe the opportunity doesn't come up for a little longer than other people. So yeah, for me, I went to uni and did sports journalism and kind of from a very young age, actually, from when I was doing my GCSEs, I was tailoring everything to wanting to be a sports journalist because I'd worked out I was never going to be good enough to be a professional sports person. But from that, I still had to, you know, work very hard from that point to when I got my first job. But that first job coming, you know, I might not have been in a position to take it. I might not have seen the application for it, whatever it may be, where there's certain things where it does. That's why I feel like you make your own luck. You have to give yourself the opportunities for that to happen. But once you get closer to this sort of thing, to almost towards like the end goal of getting a job in Formula One, as it was for me, or to report on it, then you get the chance to show what you can do. And that comes down to the hard work and the graft. And then the opportunities are only going to come because you're good enough.
Yeah.
You're not going to get those opportunities if you're not good enough.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And that passion is a big thing because a case study I always use is Harry, who does this podcast with me when Tom's not here as well. And Harry Benjamin has single-mindedly known exactly what he wants to do since he was about 16 or younger. He's like, I am going to be a commentator or a presenter, and that's all I'm going to focus on. And he's put all his eggs in that basket. And, you know, fast forward 5 or 6 years, and he's commentating on BBC Five Live alongside people that have done it for years and years and years. You know, fair play to him. But he's had that single-minded approach. And I think you've got to have that to a degree if you really want to hit the top.
I am somebody who had no idea what they wanted to do when they grew up.
I was
though.
The same.
So conversely, my career has been built on following my nose and not knowing what I wanted to do and being a bit of a chameleon and going, okay, I see the bigger picture here. This is going to be really important. Therefore, I'm going to move myself into that space. So I want to just shout out for the people that are sat at home and going, well, crap, I don't know what I want to do. That doesn't stop you being successful in this space. I think the point is you have to carve out what it is that you want for yourself. Yeah. I've been very lucky in that I've had a number of positions that have been made for me because I've said, like, I want to go off and do this. Is this possible? And they've said, yes, we'll do that, which isn't going to be the same case for everybody. But I think I don't totally agree. I am in awe of people like Chris, like Harry, same. Who have known from day one this is what I want to do, and they've been hungry and they've chased it. But there are also the people like me.
I'm in your camp. I was exactly the same. And I had no idea what I was doing. Even as a 23-year-old, I was floating around like an absolute bum. And it did take a stroke of luck for me to get into Formula One. And I've stayed there ever since. But even when I was in it, it took me a long time to find my niche. And then when I did, and which turned out to be sponsorship, then everything changed. But it took an awful long time for me to get there.
But like even with me, like I was doing graphic design, I was doing football YouTube, and then I decided to pivot to F1. Channel started to take off. But you say about opportunity, I was like, let's start doing a podcast. And my first ever guest was Jess. She came on. And
I was like, who's this kid who makes really nice thumbnails?
Yeah. See, that was my way in. The pink thumbnails got me in, right? And then I had Tommy on, then I had Matt on, and then Matt offered me a job at WTF1 editing. So then that enabled me to do my channel more full-time and put more time into it. And it all, like, there's all these little instances where, again, that was luck in a way, but also I reached out to you. I was proactive in reaching out, you could have ignored me, but you didn't. And you know what? We're here today. So
yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I don't want to labour the point too much. I appreciate it was one question that we'll spend 20 minutes on. But I had a mate, my best mate at uni, who got like an award at the end of our degree for being basically the best sports journalist on the course, which I actually didn't mind. I remember it, but I wasn't like, oh, it should have been me. I genuinely thought he was better. But the problem was, his attitude then was when he came out that, well, I'm a good sports journalist, I'm now qualified, I should get a job at this sort of level. And I went and did an unpaid internship and then worked evenings and weekends at the BBC logging football, which was great. I got paid to watch football, but it meant all I did really was work. But then most of my spare time would have been spent watching football anyway. And I was doing this 9 to 5, during the week I was doing this unpaid internship at Bauer Media. So I was getting experience. And that meant that when the ESPN F1 job came along, I had this kind of attitude that they liked. And I had, a bit more of a portfolio. I had a good few references. I was also doing a bit of F1 blogging. He was just applying for jobs and waiting for one that he felt was good enough for him almost, or feeling like he should get, and not chasing it so much. And it didn't quite work for him in the same way. And his career didn't kind of go in the direction he'd have hoped. And not initially anyway. So I always felt then, I was like, mate, you've got to go and be more proactive. You've got to go and make it happen for yourself. Just because you've got so far along the path that you think you now deserve it doesn't mean
it's not going to come.
It will happen.
Yeah.
And if you stay still, it definitely won't happen.
Yeah.
You're never entitled to success in life. You've still got to do your own thing. Final question. Again, collective or individual. What are you both scared of?
Planning a wedding.
Yep.
Good answer.
Goodbye bank account.
Scared of? I don't know. Have you got something?
I've got one. And it genuinely is, it's the day that I struggle for work. And it's as a freelancer is I say yes to everything, because you just don't know the year where, even if you've done a good job, but if the business model isn't working out for a company, or they need to change what they're doing and they don't have something for you, it might not be intentional or slight on you, but it just doesn't happen. Mm. And there's not really the safety net as a freelancer. And you just keep saying yes to try and reduce that happening. And it's so my fear is almost saying no to anyone to doing something, because I worry that will then come back and bite me in the future. And I'll be sat really worrying about where our future's going. And if we do talk, more broadly as a couple, we're talking about a wedding, getting married, obviously, hopefully future family and stuff, and house, we've got a dog, all these things you're trying to support. Mm. And knowing that professionally you're doing all this, and right now it's going great, but it is kind of, the foundations might not be quite so strong as it would be in a full-time capacity going through a business and climbing the ranks or whatever, is a kind of fear of mine, I'd say. Mm.
Mine's probably like getting old and becoming irrelevant. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I've hit that age now where people are telling me, oh my God, you're so cringy. Like, why do you say that?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, crikey. Like, oh no, I'm going to have to bow down to these younger people, especially in, like, I guess the area I currently work in. It's all a bit, the younger generation tends to lead the trend and lead what's cool. So you have to kind of be like, do not be that cringy person that's trying to be down with the kids, but also like embrace it at the same time.
But you've got that. You've got, what I find with that, and I'm with you, because I'm to Chris's point, I'm also a freelancer and a contractor, and I have been since 2012, and sympathize completely with those fears. And it all compounded with me. I lost a giant, my major client a few years ago and had to rent out my house, you know, move in with the in-laws, all the disaster. And then 2 years later, you're back up again, and it's a roller coaster. So I get that. But the age thing is interesting. I'm 41, and most of the people in the office that I consult with, they're probably in their 20s to mid-20s, some late 20s. It's quite a young company. And they look at me like a dad. I'm like, I'm 41. Yeah. I can still drink 10 pints of beer. And they're like, yeah, well, we don't do, beer's not very cool anymore. I'm like, damn
beer,
it.
Beer, no. Like, what?
But what I like is that when you've been in the business for a little while and you're getting a few gray hairs, you have that extra experience and knowledge. And I feel like now you could put me in many scenarios and I'll feel comfortable and I won't feel worried about a person of a certain hierarchy or, you know, dealing with a difficult situation. The flip side is you have that experience and that's where it can be quite cool to be a little bit, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 30 in a month, just over a month.
Knocking on, mate.
So, yeah, I know, right? But I still think you're my podcast dad. So. Oh,
see? And I bet you don't think I'm cool either. No,
I mean, come on, Tim.
Yeah, not cool. Well, listen, Jess, Chris, absolutely brilliant to have you on. Apologies we've kept you for so long, but really, really good fun. And I hope people learn a bit from this show as well, because there's some really good nuggets there that you mentioned. All the best with both of your respective careers and long may they continue. And I'm sure we'll speak again. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first-class hotels, travel and exclusive behind-the-scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend, F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So, to book your F1 Experiences package, head online to f1experiences.com, and if you enter the code MMPODCAST, you'll get 5% off as well.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review, and until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win. And also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.